This week on the show, March Madness is underway. There's a lot going on in baseball as we approach opening day. Speaking of baseball, in brackets, there was a bad one that involved both of them. We'll discuss all that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome into the Calling It podcast, recording Friday, March 22nd, 11:30 in the morning, so before the day two of March Madness gets underway. I'm Alex Barth, joined by Alex Lebowitz. We're powered by CLNS Media. Lebowitz, we'll get right into it. One day into March Madness, how's your bracket look?
It looks good. You know, we had this conversation a little bit, and I've had this conversation a number of times. In years past, I've been a one-bracket type of guy. Fantasy football, it's one team, and that's where you go all in on. I've changed my ways this year because I want to make money because I'm a degenerate. So I've created three brackets. But if it's any consolation, the bracket I created first, the one that's my baby, the firstborn child, which parents love more than the other children. That's just a fact. That's the one that's doing the best for me. I'm in the first in that pool, and then another pool I'm doing, I'm also in the first in that one. So I'm doing pretty well. I'm feeling pretty good, but you know, there's another day of round one matchup, so I'll probably feel differently by the end of the day.
See, I just do one bracket because I'm not a psychopath, and I think that if that's what you're picking to happen, pick something, stick with it, stick by your word. A man is only as good as his word, right? But my problem is, so I normally am pretty aggressive with my picks. I normally end up picking more upsets than I probably should. I picked like no upsets this year. The big one I had is I had Yale and Belmont facing off in the second round. And that was really it. I had a couple 10 seeds winning. I had Oregon winning two games. That's it. My Final Four is 2-1s, 2-2s. So I thought this year, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. I normally lose a Final Four team the first 2 days. Not this year. I'm playing super safe. I'm like the 30th percentile. It sucks. I picked no upsets. There were no upsets. And somehow I'm still at the bottom of the standings, which is just such classic March pain.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's a crapshoot. And the thing that's ironic is I didn't pay attention at all this entire season to college basketball.
The reason I picked no upsets, I watched less college basketball this year because I was working with the Patriots for the first time. I watched less college basketball this year than I ever have in my life. So I felt really good because it's always the person who doesn't really know what's going on that wins the pool. I didn't have the burden of knowledge. I liked my chances.
Well, and that's how I feel. Like in years past, when I've actually paid attention to the college basketball season, that's when I trip myself up, start to get too cute. Oh, they have really good perimeter defense. Maybe they can. And it never goes the way I want it to. So this year, it's just a crapshoot. I didn't go like who has the better mascot route. But I was just trying to go. I was just going with my gut. And so far, again, it has worked. But I also kind of went the route that you did. I didn't pick many upsets. I did pick Murray State over Marquette. I am proud about that one in one of my brackets, that is, in my baby.
You can't do that. You can't say, oh, I picked this upset, because I could have made a bunch of brackets and picked all the upsets. Like, you don't get to do that when you make more than one bracket.
But no, but I preface this by saying my baby, the firstborn, that's the one I'm going with. So when I'm talking to people, I won't bring up the other ones. I'll try to stop doing that.
Yeah, you get one. You only get one.
And this is the one I got.
Okay, I think if you win money on the other two, you should have to donate it to charity. Like, it's a major asterisk on that win.
Donate to charity. I'm pocketing that money and then gambling it more. That's what I'm doing. It's going to recycle into my degeneracy. So, yeah, but I'm feeling good about it. It's a crapshoot. Day one was a success. Day two and day three, really by the end of the weekend, that's when I'm done. Come Sunday, I check back in. Probably won't be doing too hot, but you always remain somewhat optimistic. I just hope to win one of these so that I can make my money back. That said, didn't put much money down, but again, not many big upsets, no surprises yesterday, really. So it's looking pretty good.
All right, let's talk about the actual games. Let's talk about the actual basketball. Yesterday, overall, you know, pretty disappointing day. You had one big upset, which we'll get to in a second. That was Murray State over Marquette. But it's really tough to count 10s over 7s. You don't really count 9 over 8s. That's a wash. So you did. I think you had two 10 seeds win, right? Florida was a 10. And then yep. I know Minnesota was a 10 because I picked that one correctly.
Yeah.
But really not much in the way of upsets yesterday. It was pretty much chalk. I don't know. Like, some people probably like that because it helped their brackets. But I, even when it's against my bracket, I normally like to see, you know, give me a 13, give me a 14, something like that.
Yeah. And I think you'll get that today. And we did have some good matchups. Like, some of the games were closer than maybe they should have been. You know, Bradley played Michigan State, really tough. Vermont, UVM, a lot of people were high on them going in the tournament. They got shafted going up against Florida State, and they've been red hot, obviously going to the ACC final and losing to Duke, but they were playing really well heading into that one. And then obviously the 11 versus 6 were mostly really good. Auburn, New Mexico State was a nail biter. So you had games that were close enough, but again, a lot of those 13 versus 4 seeds, they did not pan out because, I mean, when it comes down to it, talent's going to win. And when these teams take it into that extra gear, you know, a UVM isn't going to be able to match up. And we saw that yesterday. But again, today, I think we will see some tough matchups, some potentially 13, 14 seeds that play whoever they're going up against pretty hard. One game I'm looking at personally is UC Irvine versus Kansas State. Kansas State, another team that's highly touted. A lot of people are high in them, but UC Irvine has had an exceptional season, so look out for that one. Ohio State over and Iowa State. We'll see. But you're going to see some upsets. You're going to see one of those underdogs, those dark horses, go deep into the tournament. I think right now we're still trying to find out what team that is. Maybe it's Murray State.
And by the time people listen to this, those games might have already started. So let's talk about what we've seen, specifically Murray State.
Sure.
Ja Morant is ready for the NBA. That was I was at the games yesterday in Hartford, which, by the way, was a total dumpster fire. We can talk about that in a little bit. Hartford should never host a tournament ever again. But Ja Morant put on a show. That kid is something else. How he ended up at Murray State, I do not know. Like, I know, but I still don't know. You know what I mean by that? Like, yeah. I get that he was under-recruited, but he played AAU with Zion, which means, obviously, as we know with the NBA, the two of them will be playing together in 4 years, which is going to be something else. But, I mean, he's got a little bit of De'Aaron Fox in him, a little bit of Kyrie Irving, and I think a lot of Russell Westbrook. And those are three – I know those are three huge names to throw out there. And he played Marquette, good, not great team. He was in the Ohio Valley all year, which outside of Belmont didn't have much competition. But you can just tell. I mean, he's a risk taker. He sees the whole floor. He's never seen a passing lane or a shot he didn't like. And that dunk was something. And, you know, he had some talent around him. That number 32 kid, whose name's escaping me, the one who made that great behind-the-back pass for the dunk, he's a big dude, but he was moving around. 6'8", 295, a little Big Baby Davis action. But, yeah, Morant absolutely put on a show yesterday. That was his – I know people have kind of been high on him getting to this point, but to me, that was his arrival. That was his coming out party.
And that name you're thinking of is Darnell Cowart.
Thank you.
He was unbelievable. And Murray State's one of those teams. They did really well in conference. They had a really good record coming in. But again, when you're in a mid-major type of conference that isn't as highly touted as a Big East, or maybe not Big East, but an ACC or an SEC or what have you, they're going to be seated relatively low, and that gives them the opportunity to kind of shock some people. That's what we saw yesterday, and Ja Morant is one of those guys who's shocking people. And I know that if you pay attention to college basketball, you know his name. You know that he's going to be a top pick come the NBA draft. But that's a huge asset to have, because when you have a playmaker in a tournament like this and you have a team like Murray State that really doesn't play very deep. The besides the starting five, they only had one player play more than 10 minutes, more than 8 minutes even. So when you get to this stage of the season, it really comes down to who your best players are. Murray State has one of the best. So again, we're looking at the teams that might be the underdog, that might be the dark horse that could make it to the Elite Eight, Sweet 16, what have you. Murray State, I think, is climbing at the top of that list of potential teams to do that.
So the interesting thing for me is, I think a lot of it yesterday, Murray State didn't necessarily have more talented basketball players. They were just much better athletes, right? Marquette had a bunch of basketball players, but almost no athletes on the floor. And they were just, they literally ran them off the floor. Murray State did Marquette. And the next round, they're going to play Florida State. And that team, I mean, you want to talk about some athletes. You want to talk about some speed and some reach. That's a track meet too. So I wonder, you know, Murray State was able to just essentially out-physical a team. Can they actually a team that's just as physical as them, can they play a better basketball game than them too? And that's going to be really interesting in the second round. You mind if I just kind of go off on the city of Hartford here for a second before
we wrap this up? Please, by all means.
The XL Center sucks. All right. I want this out there in the public because, and this is part of this is on the NCAA too. The NCAA needs to fix on what they do with tournament. First of all, they do this thing when they announce the lineups where they don't announce one team than the other. They go back and forth, one from one team, one from the other, one from one team, one from the other. It's stupid. It's annoying. They need to get rid of it. And then what they did to Hartford, and Hartford executed this poorly, because of the way the TV deal was set up, there was only supposed to be 25 minutes before the end of the game, the end of the second game in session one, and the beginning of the second, in the beginning of the first game for session two. And for those of you who haven't gone to March Madness in the first round, how it works is there's two tickets. The first ticket gets you in for games one and two of the day. The second ticket gets you in for games three and four. You can buy both together. It's called buying the full strip. But what that means is they have to completely empty out the arena in between the second game of the day and the third game of the day. When I went in Providence 2 years ago, there was like a three-hour gap. So it was easy. Everybody left, went downtown, had dinner, came back. We're supposed to have 25 minutes to do it yesterday. They actually pushed back the start of the Villanova game to accommodate. I don't know. Was that like me? Because my phone was dying at that point. And there was zero service inside the XL Center, which also sucks. Did people like notice the Villanova start got pushed back and that the stadium was essentially empty for that first half?
I personally, no. But I mean, but that's me during March Madness, the first few rounds, just like, oh, this game's on.
Right. So maybe nobody noticed because they're flipping around to games. But frankly, it's not fair to the players. They were playing in what was really an empty gym for the first half. And it's not fair to the fans who bought the tickets because people literally were still coming in during halftime. We're still coming into the building. The NCAA should not have scheduled like that. In the XL Center, it's small, it's crowded, it's hot, it reeks. They couldn't handle the task that was given to them. So I love going to games yesterday. Don't want to seem like I'm not grateful. I love going to March Madness. It's very cool. The NCAA needs to do a better job with this like they need to do with most things. And that's my rant.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never been to March Madness, any game during the March Madness. They'll be in Boston, though, eventually, probably later rounds. But you should keep it in stadiums that can accommodate the event. And going to Hartford, Connecticut, of all places, who even plays there in Hartford? Was it the Whalers facility back then?
It's the Whalers' old building. The teams that use it now are the Rangers AHL affiliate, the Wolfpack.
Uh-huh.
And UConn men's and women's basketball and men's hockey play a selection of games there. They use it part-time. They're back and forth between there and campus.
When they need more seats.
Right, but they don't have to – that's one thing. They don't have to clear it out and fill it back up in 25 minutes.
Yeah, that's such a hassle. And that's just – I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. And you're just dealing with a cluster and a facility that just can't manage it. So, again – stick to the major cities that have professional teams because
even
this is
Providence. Providence was great. Providence, they handled that well. The arena could handle it. I had no problem with Providence 2 years ago. We did the dome, the Carrier Dome. That was when I was in college. That was the Elite Eight. So it was only three games, but that was fine.
And those, so, I mean, the Carrier Dome's probably more used to
games
like that. And then Providence, I mean, it's also a way better city than Hartford, Connecticut. And Syracuse for that matter.
Building, so.
Yeah, I want to go on the record. Providence is 10 times better than Syracuse.
That's a fair assessment. All right. It is. The snow's melting outside. I can see, actually have windows today because I'm out of town for this one. I'm not in my apartment. So I can see the snow melting.
Nice.
It leads me to think about baseball.
Yep.
We got a lot of baseball. It was a crazy week in the MLB. We have a lot to talk about. We'll go rapid fire on that next. This is Calling It, powered by CLNS.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
All right, welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz with you. It's just about noon on Friday, March 22nd. Sounds like Craig Kimbrell may finally sign. That may be coming soon. That's why I prefaced this segment with the date and time, Lebowitz, because as we all know with the Paul and the Curse, as soon as we end this recording, Craig Kimbrell's going to sign. So all indications are it will be the – is that him signing, that little notification?
No, that was me being an idiot and not putting my phone on silent.
No, that's what I thought it might be. Like that would have been that would have been perfect timing, but obviously we're never lucky enough to get that. Looks like it's going to be the Milwaukee Brewers. All arrows seem to point that way. I saw one report that was maybe the Cubs, but I think the Brewers' bullpen's only going to get stronger. Good bullpen already. Probably a good landing spot for Kimbrel. Kind of gets out of the spotlight a little bit. He's got, you know, help around him in that bullpen. We'll see what the money is because, you know, he's going to be – the contract's going to be defined by his holdout and those ridiculous requests that he had made. But, you know, not it's a logical spot for him to end up. And good on the Brewers, too. That's a great addition for them, a team that, you know, sits right on the cusp of being a serious contender.
Yeah, I mean, right on the cusp. I would argue that they're already there. I mean, that was a team that had an exceptional season last year, right? They topped their division in a really tough NL Central. They were the top team in – forget about topping their division. They were the top team in the National League. Now you add what some would call an elite closer, although he has been shaky.
They're still chasing the Dodgers, though? Because people – like, yeah, they finished with a better record than the Dodgers last year, but the Dodgers were hurt all year last year. We never got to see what the Dodgers would be as a full team. I like the Dodgers, but the Brewers are right there. They're certainly the better regular season.
I would say the Dodgers are chasing themselves. They got to get over that hump. That's
a very good point, actually. Yeah.
That's a team that's, you know, they're always right there, but they've never actually gotten it done. They're kind of like the Washington Capitals to an extent, except the Washington Capitals actually won.
They finally got one.
They finally actually did it. Now we're just waiting on the Dodgers to do the same. But I think with this addition, that lineup, their pitching overall, the Brewers are an exceptional team. And this is a team that's definitely going to be in the hunt with or without someone like Craig Kimbrel. If they do bring him aboard and they have the room to bring him aboard financially, yeah, you do it. I mean, he's definitely not a detriment, and he gives you some extra depth. The question is, when you get to October, will he fizzle out like he did with the Red Sox? Will you try to control how much you're throwing him or putting him out there to avoid that happening? We'll see. But they already have some guys in that bullpen who are pretty damn good. So maybe we have a fight too. Another question I'm asking is what are the figures when Kimbrel does get signed? The fact that he is close to signing with the team means that you know, either he budged or these teams have budged. If I had to guess, I'd say we're the former. Because I don't know, most teams don't want to invest 6 years on a 31-year-old reliever who's a power pitcher at that. So we'll see how it turns out, but it's definitely a good move for the Brewers if they end up pulling the trigger.
And it seems like one way or the other, this means Craig Kimbrel not coming back to Boston. So that kind of last, I don't know what you want to call it, sliver of hope for the Red Sox bullpen to start the season out the window. And, I mean, we'll have this conversation again. This is really the last time we can have it in theory before we see it put into practice, is who is the Red Sox closer. I know Matt Barnes threw a good inning yesterday, so I guess that makes him the leader in the clubhouse. But I'm on record saying I think it will be Durbin Feltman at some point, but he's not going to come up till probably June or July, at the earliest May, because they're not going to burn the extra year on his contract, help them win, to help them win maybe, what, 3-4 games in April, you'd use the closer. So what are we looking at here? I mean, this is a major problem. This is a team that's supposed to be a contender, but we've seen teams like this before. This is the Dave Dombrowski special. Most of the rosters is good or better than any other team in the league, but you get to the bullpen, and it can be enough to derail the whole operation. Here we are once again.
I think that Alex Cora is going to have his bullpen fight for it. I don't think he's naming anyone specifically. It's going to be a closer by committee, and whoever performs well through April or May is going to get that job. Unless no one lives up to the expectations or exceeds those expectations. In that case, you'll see Dombrowski make a move, which I think is inevitable anyway. But if I had to guess, I think Matt Barnes is the best bet to take over that closer role for the time being. If not, maybe a Ryan Brazier, if he continues to build off what we saw from him last year. But even then, that sample size is not very big. The reality is they're going to have to make some moves. They're going to have to bring someone in from the outside, at the very least, to add some depth to that bullpen. Right now, I see it as a closer by committee type of situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're looking. But again, even the by committee part, there's guys that I don't trust in a committee, which is kind of where I'm a little worried about this.
Well, if you have I mean, the two guys, it's going to be Matt Barnes and Ryan Brazier, it's looking like.
But Ryan Brazier, at this time last year, was the guy who had most recently pitched in the Japanese minor league system. Like, they got a great year out of him. Don't get me wrong. But that's not a guy, you know, I'm giving the key to the city right now.
Well, listen, 2013, they brought in Koji Uehara. And he was a good reliever. He was someone who is, you know, below 2.5 ERA and was considered a good setup man. They brought him in as a closer, and he did very well in 2013. I'm not saying that's what you should expect.
You can't bank. You can't. That's what they're essentially banking on another miracle in the bullpen.
I don't think it's a miracle. I think we saw some production out of him. I think, if anything, it's maybe not what you'd expect, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. And again, when you have an offense as good as a lineup as good as the Red Sox lineup, you can afford to you know, maybe not have the strongest bullpen in the league, especially when you combine that with the fact that their starting rotation, which no one really talks about, but their starting rotation is maybe the best in baseball, especially with Nathan Eovaldi.
As long as Chris Sale stays healthy.
And that's and, a big that, – that's
Eduardo Rodriguez, big, too, to a lesser extent.
That's a big what if. Yeah, Eduardo Rodriguez isn't going to stay healthy. I'll give you that spoiler alert right now.
The question is, how many games is he healthy for? Because you're not going to get him for the full 30. Are you getting him for 10? Are you getting him for 20? That's really the huge difference. And it could be either. I think either one's just as likely. But that to me is the second biggest question behind Sale's health and that pitching rotation is, how many games are you getting out of Eduardo Rodriguez? Now, will you get the full 30, but just how many do you get? And when do you get them?
I don't think you can trust Eduardo Rodriguez at all. But even without him, because the fifth starter is one where, one, you have off days, so you can skip that spot in the rotation, although you might not want to do that with Chris Sale, who gets injured relatively easily. They're going to be cycling, you know, whether it's Velasquez or Brian Johnson through that fifth spot if Eduardo Rodriguez doesn't pitch to his capabilities. But who knows? Maybe he's due. We've talked about it in years past with David Price. He's due to pitch well to have a good start in the postseason. We saw it last October. And I know with Eduardo Rodriguez, it's more of a health issue. But maybe, just maybe, he can put together a decent season. Because we have seen stretches where he pitches like an all-star caliber guy. It's just he hasn't been able to put it together. All he needs to do is be a solid fifth starter, and they're going to look all right, and that will alleviate the concerns that we have with that bullpen.
All right. So you talked about the Red Sox lineup for a little bit. Mookie Betts back in the news because Mike Trout signs that record-breaking contract, and now, you know, where are we at with Mookie Betts? Alex Bregman signed for, what was it, 10 years, $100 million?
Is that what it was?
5 years, $100 million?
I think it's five, I want to say.
Years. Either way, Bregman signed something that seemed like chump change compared to all these contracts we've been seeing. Which I don't want to say is the floor for Mookie Betts because he's way above that. But I think the Red Sox original offer was above that as well. But you kind of see the span these contracts are coming in on. Can Mookie Betts ask for more money than Mike Trout, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. Or is he going to be – does he have to kind of find himself within the trees of the Trout contract and the Harper contract and the Machado contract?
I don't think it's going to be what Trout's is because Trout – we've never seen anything like Mike Trout, and that's not an exaggeration. He's the most well-rounded player through this point in his career than anyone else to play the game. So that's why he earned that, you know, 12, 13 year, whatever it was, $430 million contract. Betts won't get that, but he's going to get closer to that than what Harper got. That's for damn sure. I think it's going to be, you know, that 11 to 13 year range of probably around $400 million. And I think that he deserves it. The guy just won an MVP. He's put together like three or four really good years for the Red Sox, and he's turned into one of the best players in the MLB. The question is, when are they going to offer that contract? When are they going to get that deal done? There are reports that he was offered an 8-year, $200 million contract, which he declined wisely.
It's insulting.
It's insulting. Hopefully that combined with the fact that, you know, they've lowballed him during arbitration doesn't hinder his desire to stay in Boston. But you're going to see a substantial deal, the biggest ever given out in Boston, probably the second biggest contract ever. And I'd assume that deal is going to be official by the end of the year because the Red Sox, they're about marketability. Who's more marketable than Mookie Betts? They'd be dumb not to extend a massive contract his way.
So what the Red Sox cannot do is John Lester this. They cannot lose this guy. I think you say $420 million, you can pick anywhere between 10 or 15 years. Do you want the AAV? do you want the job security? Right? Pick one. And that's just, I think that's what you do with him. That's the only way you're going to keep him. If he hits the open market, bye. He's gone. Because some team's going to give him $500 million. So, okay. And I would hate to see the Red Sox John Lester in this situation. It would be just utterly disgraceful.
And the one thing that gives me the impression they will not do that is the fact that John Henry has come out in the past couple of weeks and he admitted to handling that situation poorly, which I think was a good step. I hate John Henry. I hate the Red Sox ownership. But the fact that they were willing to admit their fault in that and the handling of that situation, which would have been an incredible deal in hindsight. I mean, look at what John Lester's given the Cubs over the past few years since signing that deal. Yeah, it's good to see. So maybe they've learned from that mistake and they won't do it. And another thing is Mookie Betts is way more valuable than a guy like John Lester. And that's not to take anything away from John Lester. That's just more to speak on, you know, how productive and how good Mookie Betts is. You could argue he's the most talented player the Red Sox have had in our lifetime. And you know, I think the deal that he will be given will reflect that.
All right. One more baseball topic I want to touch on before we wrap this up here. We can do this quickly, but it is worth noting. The Tampa Bay Rays have announced some adjustment. We'll call them adjustments. I don't know. Is there a better word for them?
Cutbacks.
All right. I didn't want to go there, but if you want to go there, we can go there. The Rays have announced some cutbacks for home games. They will be closing the upper deck, so that drops the capacity of the Trop from just over 40,000 to 25,000 even, which makes it the smallest stadium in the majors. They will be cash only in most sections. You can't use credit card. And the gates will open 90 minutes ahead of the game instead of, you know, most major league teams, two and a half hours. No more coming in for batting practice. They got to move that team already. I don't know why any of these decisions make sense. I guess I get closing the upper deck. It's something you have to do, but it's not a good sign. The other ones just seem to alienate fans, the few fans they have. That team's got to go. There should not be professional baseball in Tampa. They still play indoors, which is a big enough problem. Tampa's not going to give a new stadium. They're never going to get outdoors, which retractable roofs are one thing. Baseball should be played outside when possible. They got to go. So I what I want to talk about is the MLB. It sounds like they're going from 30 to 32 teams at some point. My guess would be one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. I think it's Portland or Las Vegas on the West Coast. The Rays would probably stay on the East Coast. So I have it between Nashville and Montreal. Both cities are working on MLB stadiums as recently as earlier this year. They're putting proposals together. I'd love to see baseball return to Montreal, but I love Nashville as a city too. I'm kind of broken, but they just need to get the Rays the hell out of Tampa. It's embarrassing at this point is what it is.
Yeah, I wouldn't go with Montreal. We've already done that. We've already gone that route, and that team was relocated.
But they weren't relocated because there wasn't any passion. Again, it was because of the same reason they need to relocate the Rays was the stadium. The stadium was outdated. It was obsolete. Well, the city wouldn't build a new one. Now they will.
Well, the Rays should also be relocated because fans don't really show up all that often. And right. If they do, it's because of the cheap, you know.
But I think part of the reason the fans don't show up is the stadium. I think that's a major turnoff.
I think that probably plays a factor, but it's like I remember when Scott Kazmir, you know, when the Rays started to get really good late 2000s, early 2010s, and they were starting to actually contend in the AL East and in the American League, Scott Kazmir went on ESPN. He's like, people need to come to these goddamn games. Like, there's no reason why we should have 15,000 fans show up to a first place team's games. It's ridiculous. I don't think there's a lot of passion there. I think Florida is a cesspool for sports fans.
It's all transplants. You're right.
It's transplants. The Miami Heat, they don't have a legitimate fan base, in my opinion. We won't even touch on the hockey teams, but the Marlins, the Dolphins and Bucks. Okay. I'll give them a pass. They have some fans, but overall people care about college sports mostly. And they don't really, they don't really even pay attention to anything going on professionally. In regard to where you'd want to relocate it, I'd say Nashville. I think it's an easy decision. Nashville should be considered like the Las Vegas of the East in a sense that
– I mean, it is in some ways, like if we're being honest.
Oh, for sure. It's entertaining. I mean, maybe – I think New Orleans might be a better comparison.
New Orleans is another city that absolutely deserves a big – I don't know if that counts as East or West, though.
Yeah, well, it's more East than West. It's East of the Midwest.
They're in the West for basketball.
Yeah, that makes no sense. But – I think Nashville is the place to go. And I say that because you look at the Predators and their fan base after that Stanley Cup run that they had. And that's a Southern team with a really good hockey fan base. They have a good football fan base. So you can imagine they would be accepting to
and
a baseball team coming.
Just one more to throw on there. They have what is more or less perennial. Maybe. They have more or less the perennial best college baseball team in the country in Vanderbilt, Vandy, right
yeah.
there.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a baseball hunger down there. I think Nashville would be awesome. New Orleans, Montreal would all be good. And then I think on the West Coast, because what's probably going to happen is there's two teams they need to move: Oakland and Tampa, and then they'll add two teams. So between those five cities. Two of them will get transplant teams, two of them will get new teams, and one of them gets left out, I think, is ultimately what you'll see happen.
Yeah, and I think with Montreal, the appeal there, again, is the international aspect of it. Another city that could be in consideration out west.
Well, there's a baseball history out there. You're going to say Vancouver?
Vancouver, but they got Seattle like 3 hours south. So
right,
I don't know if that's a tough one.
I know the NFL at one point looked at Vancouver, and it's the same thing. They felt like Seattle was too close. That it's not you're going to be butting heads too much to bring a new team there. It's not like, you know, obviously like DC and Baltimore are close, but those teams have had teams for years, and then obviously the team left Washington, came back. But
is Portland that much different? I know it's further away, but it's right in between Seattle and, you could argue, San Francisco fan base. Although San Francisco is a pretty long time.
I think it's Vancouver and Seattle, even though they're as it's been explained to me. I've actually never been out there, but as it's been explained to me,
it's like Toronto and Buffalo.
That right. They're very similar cities, even though they're in different countries. There's a lot of interest and people go back and forth a lot. I don't know that Seattle and Portland, there's not a lot of back and forth between those two cities.
Okay. I can see that. We'll see. Either way, we're kind of seeing an evolution.
But Portland's another city. I mean, they love the Blazers. That's a city that deserves another sports team. Even with the hipsters, you'd think they'd be, you know, too cool for it, but they love the Blazers.
And they got Nike, which is a big appeal. But I think we're seeing this evolution in sports in general, where we're starting to see relocations to a higher extent. We're starting to see expansion with the NHL. A city like Las Vegas that's never really had teams is starting to get a ton of them. And that's going to be one that the MLB is definitely going to look at. And they already have a minor league team out there, the Las Vegas 51ers. I think within the next decade, we'll see a lot of moving around. But this conversation with the Rays has been going on for the last decade. My whole thing is like, okay, if you're going to do a pull the trigger, and you got to get it done soon, because it's evident that this experiment in Tampa Bay just is not working out for the MLB.
All right. We had one more segment we were going to do separately, but I think this one's gone on a little bit longer, and it's a baseball segment. We can probably tie it all together. We'll just have one break in the show.
Sure.
Congratulations. You all don't have to listen to Jimmy Young twice this week. Lovitz, you brought this up, so why don't you introduce it?
Okay, so there was a poll that came out. This is from Cut4, and for those of you that don't know, it's an MLB account that pretty much just plays highlights of what's going on in the MLB. It's a great follow if you're trying to get highlights. A horrible follow if you're trying to get movie advice or seating for a movie bracket. So they, in the spirit of March Madness, they created a bracket, at least up to 8 seeds, of best baseball movies of all time. So I'm going to go 1 through 8, and then I'll give my opinion. We'll get your reaction too as well, Barth. 1, The Sandlot. 2, Major League. 3, Field of Dreams. 4, Moneyball. 5, Rookie of the Year. 6, Bill Durham. 7, League of Their Own. 8, Little Big League. One of the most horrendous lists in the history of lists, I would have to say. One of the worst brackets in the history of brackets. Whoever did this should get fired, and that's not an exaggeration. Just completely brutal. The Sandlot is a great childhood movie. I watched this movie every single weekend. I kid you not. Every single weekend when I was in third grade, I would go to my buddy Chris's house. We'd do a sleepover, and we would watch this movie because we were baseball junkies, and we loved The Sandlot, because how could you not? That said, to put that as a number one baseball movie of all time, ahead of Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, League of Their Own, and Major League, I just can't. It's inexcusable.
Look,
it is disgusting.
There's clearly a skew towards comedy on this list.
There's a skew towards children movies.
Well, you could say they're one and the same, but Cut 4 is supposed to be sort of a comedy account, right? So what they should have done is done it in region. Although I don't. What is Little Big League? Like, why is that escaping me?
Little Big League's the one where the kid's grandfather, who's the owner of the Twins, passes away, and he takes over the team, and he fires he fires the coach, and he makes himself he fires the manager, and he makes himself the manager of the team. It's a good movie. I enjoyed it when I was young. It's silly, but I enjoyed it. It's kind of like Rookie of the Year. Henry Rowan got
it. I remember what you're talking about now. I saw that movie a long time ago. I haven't seen it in a while. What they should have done, and this could sort of maybe help alleviate how you're feeling, they should have done it as two regions. They should have done the baseball comedies and the baseball dramas. So you would have had the Sandlot, Little Big League, Major League, and Rookie of the Year. Right? That's more or less. Yep. So I would have done those two as 1 through 4, and then Field of Dreams. I'm just reading these down in whatever order. Moneyball, Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, and A League of Their Own as 1 through 4 in another bracket. I think that would have, sort of tempered what you're talking about there, because they clearly had an emphasis on comedy. They should just separate it.
Yeah, but and they also left a few movies out.
They did. I'm surprised they didn't do more than 8 seats. I really am. They would have been able to find 16.
And if you don't mind, I'm just going to go through what I would have out of this list, my 1 through 8. I don't have this written down. I'm just going to do it off the top of the dome. So number one for me, Field of Dreams. I don't think it gets better than Field of Dreams. It's my favorite baseball movie of all time, my favorite sports movie of all time, and one of my favorite movies in general of all time. It's top 10 on my list, on Lebo's movie list. Yeah. Number two, Bull Durham. Kevin Costner, I think, should be in the Hall of Fame for his contributions towards baseball. Both those movies are exceptional. Again, great movies along with great sports movies. Number three. Now this is where it gets tricky, because I'm between League of Their Own and Major Leagues. I'm going to go Major League, just cause it's kind of the first comedy baseball movie. Although you had Bad News Bears, which is also a really good one. Number four would be League of Their Own. Number five, I'll go Sandlot. Number six, I will go Moneyball. 7, Rookie of the Year. 8, Little Big Leagues. They left off The Natural, which I've never seen in its entirety. I need to see that. I know that's bad. 61, they left off about Roger Maris. They left off The Rookie with Dennis Quaid.
That's such a good movie.
And there's a few more that are escaping me.
Yeah, The Rookie should be on there. 42 is a pretty good movie.
42 is another one, which I think is better than maybe a couple movies on this list. It's not great, but it was
a good
movie.
Let's be honest. It's a baseball movie. It might not be the same. 4 Days in October.
But that's a documentary.
It's an emotional journey.
I'll agree with that. It is an emotional journey. If you want to talk about sports documentaries, that's a different genre for me personally. But the point being, this is a brutal list. I just can't get over it. And I think
it's MLB sanctioned too. Remember that. Cut 4 is an MLB brand. It's not independent.
It is. And so I think that these lists are made in part to rile people up and to piss them off.
Oh, of course.
You're doing an injustice. This is a serious topic, people. You got to take it seriously. And when you're leaving off movies like, The Rookie, and you have The Sandlot ahead of Field of Dreams and Bull Durham, I can't take you seriously. I just cannot take you seriously. So that's my TED Talk.
Let me throw one more. Just since we're talking about sports movies, I came up with this the other week. Because I was watching Die Hard. Uh-huh. It was on – Die Hard sucks on cable, by the way. Don't watch Die Hard on cable. It's like the first time I've ever watched it on cable.
Yeah.
The whole Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? I think I came up with the sports equivalent of that.
Okay.
Is Happy Gilmore a hockey movie?
It's
obviously a golf movie, but is it also a hockey movie? Because I say yes. Any movie that gets in – Terry O'Reilly's like a pretty notable figure, but – unless you're a true hockey fan, you don't know who – most people do not know who Terry O'Reilly is.
No, no one outside of
Casual Bob. Hockey fans do not know who Terry O'Reilly is. Any movie that's willing to get in-depth enough to mention Terry O'Reilly, correctly, the way they talk, they go in-depth about Terry O'Reilly at the beginning, that's a hockey movie.
You see, this is what puts it over the top for me, and I'm going to agree with you. It is partially a hockey movie. I'm not going to put a full-boat hockey movie.
No, there's no partial. It is or it isn't. I don't think you can say that. That's such a cop-out.
It's not a cop out.
It's a cop out. It is or it isn't.
Do I associate the movie with hockey in any degree? Yes. And it's one, because obviously he wanted to be a hockey player, but two, because of the putter. The putter is half
the putter. Right. The most notable prop. What's the most notable prop from that movie? Is it the putter or is it Chubb's hand?
Chubb's hand, probably.
Okay, so the second most notable.
They're connected though, because it was like a sentimental thing. Chubb passes away. He gets
one of the most notable props from the movie is a hockey club, and I'll say this too: one of the more famous hockey chirps from all time. I don't know if it's a chirp, but you know, is that net regulation size?
Yeah, that comes
from that movie. I would say it is absolutely Happy Gilmore is absolutely a hockey movie.
I'm the only guy to ever take off my skate and try to stab somebody.
There's like good hockey one-liners that have nothing to do with golf.
No, we should save this topic because hockey movies, that's also a decent genre.
There's some great – we'll say that maybe for Close to Stanley Club. We can get into hockey. Oh, I mean, there's a clear number one though. It's like number one, and then you have to see the next one at number four.
Miracle.
Yeah, absolutely. I met Mike Ruzzioni this week.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
He's a really nice guy.
Well,
really
he's a
cool
coach
guy.
Waltham or what? Weymouth?
Winthrop, where he's
Winthrop,
from.
That's what it is.
Yeah, the rink there is named after him. Really cool guy. Really nice guy. Some amazing stories.
We have a friend who played who knows him very well. A friend whose father played hockey with him at BU.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. I love New England hockey. There's all those connections like that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. This was a baseball segment. We're getting way off the rails now. Thanks for hanging with us, everybody, this week. We'll be back next. Is next week our Red Sox preview? When do the Red Sox start?
Yeah, next Thursday is opening day.
All right. So we'll do a show Wednesday night or Thursday morning. We will have our Red Sox preview for you next week.
And one more. Speaking of that Red Sox opener, they're playing the Mariners. Shout out Ichiro Suzuki.
Yes.
Best contact hitter to ever live. Probably, maybe, arguably. A great ambassador of the game. It's sad to see him go.
Well, I'll say this. Shame on the MLB for like secretly having opening day in Japan.
Yeah.
we went through the biggest baseball headlines. We didn't even talk about that, which is how poorly I get why they want to do it for Ichiro. They could have done it a week later.
And by the way, that stadium looked like Tropicana Field. Speaking of Tropicana Field,
I've actually heard amazing things about it, though.
About that venue?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It looks like technologically, it's really up to date. They built it a while ago, but they've been constantly improving it.
Yeah, that's Japan for you.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we'll be back next week with our Red Sox preview. That'll probably be it, unless something huge happens elsewhere. We'll probably just talk baseball next week. I'm looking forward to getting back in baseball season. Make sure you follow the show on Twitter at Callin Podcast and check us out online at clnsmedia.com. For Alex Lovitz, I'm Alex Barth. This has been Callin It. Thanks for listening.